Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. I'm very pleased to tell you that Jack Marks is back on Conversations today. Jack won a Walkley Award in 2006 for his essay, I Was Russell Crowe's Stooge, which is one of the most painfully funny anecdotes you'll ever read, and it's certainly worth looking up and reading on the web. But that story is perhaps for another day. And that's because Jack Marks has been collecting a bunch of sad but true stories from Australian history. The heartbreaking fire at Luna Park. The war hero who returned from World War II to be devastated by a tragedy at home. The girl who survived a motorbike accident only to be rescued by a psychopath. Well, Jack's collated these stories and many more besides and written them up in the style of a dime store novel in a new book called Australian Tragic, Gripping Tales from the Dark Side of Our History. True stories they are as well. Jack Marks, welcome back to Conversations.
G'day, how are you?
Has this book been giving you nightmares, Jack?
It did for a while. I had to renew a couple of old prescriptions once I'd finished it. You dive in there to the newspapers and dig up all the old horrible dirt from other people's lives. One thing it does do for you is make you feel happy that you have such a comfortable existence. I think that's maybe why we like stories like this. It's because they remind us of how good life is.
They make us grateful, these stories, don't they?
Yeah, and it's always one step away to... all of these tragedies that happen in this book happen to pretty ordinary people who are just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
You've been collecting these stories mostly from newspaper articles and interviews and personal experience too. I wonder what that's like for you to be going through those newspaper articles that can be from anywhere from, 10 years ago to the 1880s. If you're reading the newspaper article, you must be always in the horror of the moment.
But also I suppose for myself as a journalist, there's a bit of intrigue as with regards to how the news is reported. Like I fell right into the style of the old reporting back in the early part of the 20th century. No bylines back then. They were just writing flat-out news for pages. And there was a tremendous dramatic style of big eight-decker headlines that, amazing scenes, really caught you in. And some might call that sensationalism, I suppose. But and we've still got a lot of sensationalism in the papers. But there's a sort of style of long-form writing back then that was really literally wonderful.
And you've revived it in book form, I suppose.
Well, that's what I wanted to create with this. I was really into that idea of recreating those sort of magazines or penny dreadfuls that you read when you were a kid that made you want to pull the covers up over your head. I wanted that same sort of freak show approach to true stories.
I it had that effect on me. I almost wanted to, reading it, my wife could hear me go, oh, no. Oh, God.
I'm really into the story where it's a known disaster, but you don't know that person is heading towards it. It's like, suddenly, oh, no, they happen to be there on that particular day. So there's a lot of that in the book. You're reading about someone fairly normal, someone suburban, but suddenly you realise they're heading towards this terrible moment in history.
That's right. And there's that sense you're writing it backwards from that moment, I suppose. They've got an appointment. It's coming up in a future and it's not a good one.
I suppose I'm into that too, that very David Lynch idea that there's a white picket fence. But because they're all in a book called Australian Tragic, it's not going to end well, no matter how Holly Hobby the beginning has set up.
Yes, it's a reminder. Stop hoping. Yes, stop hoping. It won't do you any good at all. Now, Jack, there's the front part of the book, I suppose, is a bit of a manifesto, if you like, about Australian history, how you think it's been written thus far and what you think ought to be different about it, Jack.
Well, I suppose necessarily the education departments have fashioned our history for us, fixated upon the victors, the people who got there first, or the people who are in authority, Lachlan Macquarie, you know, Governor Bligh, Captain Cook. You know, these are very important people, but it would be rather the same as if in 200 years someone wrote a history of what life was like in the first decade of the 21st century, and it was nothing but chapters on Kevin Rudd, Malcolm Turnbull, Dick Smith, the adventurer, and, you know, John Farnham. It's just, you want more than that. We want our Corey Worthingtons and...
The rich soil of Australian life as it has been lived.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of history as lived through the tabloids in a way. And, you know, I see newspapers of old as very much, you know, the bedrock of the modern tabloid tradition. It was very hard for me to go back and lucky dip a paper from the past and not find an incredible story in it. You know, that's the thing that I found incredible. You know, I had to stop somewhere, so I stopped and got in on my deadline, but I really could have sat there for 7 years reading just all these remarkable tales that, you know, unless someone goes back and unearths them, will never be heard again.
It's a different style of writing for you because you've extracted yourself from these tales.
Yeah,
Jack.
Well, I mean... I suppose the great criticism of my writing, and there has been a lot of criticism of it over the years, is that Jack Marks can't write a story unless Jack Marks is the star of it. So this time I decided I was going to, if I do have a writing talent, I was going to put it in the service of the stories and keep myself as the, you know, voice of God.
Well, I want to drag you back into it today because okay. The story of how you found these stories and spoken to some of the people in the cases where people involved are still alive is pretty fascinating, Jack. So I want to bring you back in if that's all right.
Yeah, sure.
Did you have any... let's start with an early on tale, actually, where you're not involved, actually. The story of J.J. Greer, and this is from the 1880, a man we don't remember... And we ought to remember him. Tell me about J.J. Greer.
Well, if J.J. Greer was around today, he would have dominated the front page of the tabloids for several weeks, you know, possibly months. But what happened is one night at the opera in Melbourne, the old Melbourne Opera House in Bourke Street, he came back from intermission, saw that his wife, his pretty French wife, was talking to another Frenchman who had a bit of a reputation around Melbourne as a pants man, and pulled a revolver out of his suit pocket and shot his wife in the face, and the Frenchman too, and then ran to the front of the dress circle and blew his brains out. And this was all
in a crowded theatre.
This was on the opening night of a new opera at Melbourne Opera House, right down in the expensive seats. You know, he blew his blood and brains all over the people in the, you know, front rows. It was massive news for weeks down in the Melbourne papers. And interestingly, it's a great little caught in amber sort of lesson in what life was like in Victorian times, because as news came out over the ensuing days that the wife and the Frenchman had been having an affair, the press turned on them because they survived their wounds.
They survived being shot in the head.
They survived. Unfortunately, the French wife was not quite as pretty as she was beforehand, but they both survived, and Melbourne society, led by the media, started turning on them and started supporting this poor J.J. Greer, who'd been cuckolded by his wife and a fiendish Frenchman.
So he suddenly became this man, even though he shot people, he became, and himself, and soiled everyone.
He became a hero. The Frenchman, fellow by the name of Saudry, who was out here working for the French government, got kicked out of a taxi one night when the taxi driver discovered who he was. And the wife of Mr. Greer tried to get a steamer back to England, and when the captain found out she was on board, he actually turned around in Melbourne Harbour and dumped her back at Port Melbourne. He refused to take such a woman on his ship. And about a year later at Maitland, there was a wax museum kind of exhibition that featured among other things, you know, there were the assassination of Lincoln and, you know, various little scenes depicted in dioramas. And there was J.J. Greer at the opera depicted heroically, you know, like Custer at the Last Stand, shooting these bullets into these two slithery heathens. It's, I mean, as a description of what life was like in stressed up Victorian Australia, they don't come much better than that one.
There was a fascination, you know, reenacting these scenes on the stage. I astonished to see in that fantastic underrated movie, The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, that Robert Ford, who had assassinated Jesse James, represented the whole thing on the stage in throughout the United States for years afterwards.
Yeah. Well, it's very funny you mentioned that because while I was writing this book, I had an array of CDs that I was playing to get me in the mood for this, you know, spooky, tense sort of stuff. And one of them was the soundtrack to The Assassination of Jesse James. Another was the soundtrack to The Prestige. I don't know if you know that film.
Yeah.
Just all those sort of tense, arcane sort of soundtracks. So it seemed to suit the writing quite well. And in a perfect world, the book would be sold with the CD. But unfortunately, the world ain't perfect.
And that's what the book is all about, I suppose. Jack Marks is my guest in conversation. Jack is a journalist who's written a book called Australian Tragic, Gripping Tales from the Dark Side of Our History. While we're on the stage, let's actually go onto the stage, if you like, and the story of Arthur Dacre, the English actor, and his wife. This, because there's some weird stories around this as well, Jack.
I have to confess, I have a great affection for Arthur Dacre. He's a character I found really in British papers. I didn't find him so much in Australian ones. He was a Brit. He was a Londoner, and he and his wife were actors on the English stage and came out to Australia at the twilight of their careers when they were in their 40s because they'd been a bit down on their luck in Drury Lane and things weren't going well. And the Colonies was kind of the last bastion of the artistically aggrieved. You could go to the colonies where, you know, these poor Australians were tonguing for entertainment from overseas and wow them. You know, it had happened a couple of times. Sarah Bernhardt had actually came out and played at the State Theatre and received a standing ovation from Sydneysiders, despite the fact that the entire monologue she delivered was in French.
In French, yes. We had that tale on not so long ago, funnily enough, actually, as it turns out, yes.
Right, and anyway, so Arthur Dacre and his wife came out here, but it didn't work. They got bad, lousy reviews.
Even in the colonies,
They weren't even good enough for lowly Australians.
His wife was quite a good actress, wasn't she?
She was very well.
But he was a shocker.
He was well respected, and he was a matinee idol. He was really hired for his looks, and his wife did some good work. She, all the notices she got in England said she was a serious player, but she made the mistake of deciding to stick by her husband. And not do any roles where he wasn't hired also as a part of the cast. So her career died with him. But the dramatic climax occurred in Macquarie Street in Sydney after the final night of one of their shows at the Civic. And Arthur shot her in the heart and no bullets left, so he took a razor and cut his throat. So there's this tremendous little scene where, you know, it's like the final scene of their theatrical careers where the owner of the guest house bursts open the doors and quite a crowd of people have gathered around the Dacre room. And inside there's a woman theatrically, you know, dead on the bed with blood trickling out in little rivers, and Arthur staggering very theatrically around with his hand on his neck with this wound, pumping blood out, and he's crying out, "The agony, the agony," and they were the last words he said, and he dropped dead. And of course, news got around that this couple were being buried in Waverley Cemetery. All the businesses in Sydney closed, and they finally drew the biggest crowd of their career. And their plots are in Waverley Cemetery. And when I was reading this story, I'm sitting reading it in an English newspaper via the Library of New South Wales in the Domain, and I suddenly realised, I'm sitting 100 yards from where they died in the guest house on Macquarie Street. So, you know, this story that went right round the world and I'm sitting right there. And, you know, the funny thing is I've never heard of these people. I think,
why haven't we heard of these people? That's an extraordinary story. Why has that been expunged from historical memory?
I guess because it was considered not important. It was...
Were we embarrassed by failure or something?
I think it's probably melodramatic to say that, but maybe the compilers of Australian history think, well, okay, who are the important joists in the scaffold? And joists in the scaffold are very good, but you need the colour in amongst that. You know, I describe it in the introduction in the book as rather like, it would be rather like going to the football and commenting all day upon the umpires or the sponsors up in the corporate box. The really interesting stuff is happening in the stands. You know, that's what gives you the accurate picture about the mood of the day. Not necessarily the handsomest picture, but certainly a more accurate and interesting one.
Jack, I want to talk about some stories that are closer to the present day a little bit later, but I want to go stick back to the historical record for a little while longer, because there's a story in there that I'd never heard before about a woman called Queenie Thompson.
Queenie Thompson, Merle Oberon.
Who said she was from Tassie.
Mm. Well, she was born in Calcutta, half-caste, in kind of very lowly circumstances. And in those days, in the 30s and 40s, it just wasn't done to be such a bitter. So the moguls in Hollywood decided that Merle, you know, they'd recreate a history for Merle Oberon.
And she was so very beautiful.
Oh, she was very exotic and you know, striking. So I guess they decided, you know, where can we find on the globe that's distant? It's the middle of nowhere, and no one's ever going to go there to check, and they're probably so dumb they don't keep their records anyway. Tasmania.
Errol Flynn's from there.
Picked Tasmania. Yeah. It sounded great. I mean, it's a great sounding name. It's Tasmania. It sounds very exotic. And
on the furthest point of the globe.
Yeah, yes. And so they decided that Merle Oberon came from Tasmania. So all her life, that was the story that was told. And for some reason, which only Merle could answer, she accepted an invitation to come here in 1979 to host what was the equivalent of the Logies, I think.
Now, at that point, her face had been horribly scarred.
She'd gone through the mill trying to... her skin at one stage had reacted to the makeup that was being applied. So she went to some well-known surgeon in New York to get blemishes ground off with a diamond burr, and it didn't work out. So she had these scars on her face. She also was involved in a motor car accident, which left a scar above her left eye, I think. And so they developed a bunch of studio lights that are known as the Merles or the Oberons, which, you know, flash and flare out any scar tissue on the face. But By 79, she was an old woman. She'd, you know, had her career in Hollywood, and she decided she was going out with a younger man called Robert Walters, who I think might have suggested to her, "Yes, I'd like to go to Tasmania and see your birthplace." She'd obviously fed him the story. By now, Merle had come to believe it, I think. And so the mayor of Hobart got wind of this and decided to put on a grand homecoming for Merle Oberon, and sent his minions to all four corners of the island to search for information about where she was born and where she went to school, and very depressing. You know, they came back one by one saying, "We can't find evidence of this woman anywhere." And slowly it began to dawn on the authorities in Tasmania that this was all a farce.
She'd
that
lied.
Merle Oberon was not from Tasmania. And a few phone calls were made to Hollywood, and sure enough they revealed that that was the truth. So this homecoming was already advertised and set up and ready to go, locked and loaded.
They went ahead with it.
They went ahead with it because I guess they figured it was just too embarrassing to cancel it. So in this bizarre moment in time, Merle Oberon is standing there being applauded by the mayor, who knows it's crap, applauded by most of the invitees, who know it's crap.
I'm cringing with embarrassment as you're telling
me
this.
Well, Merle got up and only got a few lines into her speech, then theatrically or otherwise, had enormous fainting fit. What was revealed later, you know, she got on a plane and went home the next day, but what was revealed when she got back to Hollywood was that she'd had a heart attack, and she never did recover from that. She died a year later. So, you know, we killed Merle Oberon.
Without hospitality.
That's right.
That's a truly tragic story, because you feel sorry for her. I mean, she's become she's come from Calcutta and made a successful Hollywood actress, one of the biggest names in Hollywood of her era. And of course she had to invent a story. They all invented stories.
There's an even bigger sting in the tail to that story, but I'll leave that for, you know, I don't want to blow that for readers of the book, but, you know, it's about her very beginnings in Calcutta. But the most interesting thing for me about that story was that it says a great thing about Australia is that down in Tasmania, there's this staunch cottage industry that says, no, Merle Oberon came from, you know, my mother was friends with the midwife who nursed her. It's just hilarious, yeah? And they hold on to it like a cargo cult. They're waiting for Merle to return.
Jack Marks is here this morning, Australian journalist who's written a book called Australian Tragic, gripping tales from the dark side of our history. Now, let's go on to a truly sad, sad, sad tale that has echoes even today. The story of Robert Bungy, is that his name?
That's
Bungy.
Correct, yeah.
And his son. Mm. Tell me about how you uncovered this story, because I want you to insert yourself into the story, I'm afraid, Jack.
I discovered it with a tiny little inch tall mention in a newspaper from 1943 that said that Robert Bungy, RAF, Distinguished Flying Cross for his services in England, committed suicide last night on the beach at Brighton, shot himself and his one-year-old son through the head.
This is Brighton, Adelaide, is it?
Mm, and I thought, good grief, what's that about? So the more I got into it, I discovered that Robert Bungy had been born in Adelaide, signed up for flight training down there, and at the start of the war went over to England, flew in the Battle of Britain, one of the few Australians to do that, commanded a squadron of Australian flyers in the RAF who were distinguished themselves during the war over England and over Europe, and then met a girl in London while he was on leave, married her, she became pregnant, he told her to get the hell out of the Blitz and go back and live with her parents in Adelaide, which she did.
So she got on a boat then and went to Australia.
Yeah, she came to Australia and he said, I'll meet you when, you know, my war is done over here. He got released from the RAF and came home. 2 weeks after he arrived home, she died.
She'd given birth to their son,
yeah, who by that stage was, you know, 1 year old. And
How did she die?
Of meningitis. You know, they called it the traveller's disease back then, so they assumed that she picked it up on the way there. You know, perfectly healthy 24-year-old woman. And Robert, who'd been through all the horrors of war, you know, had seen some incredibly ghastly things, just couldn't cope with this. And for weeks he sort of wandered like a zombie, refusing to take any help from anyone. And one night, for reasons that really only he will know, he wheeled his young boy Richard down to the beach at Brighton, pulled out his service pistol, shot Richard through the head, and then turned the gun on himself. Now, I was midway through writing this story when suddenly I just happened across another newspaper article that mentioned that Richard had survived.
How old was he?
He was one when he was shot. So then I...
Sorry, how had he survived?
I didn't know this. It just mentioned that he had survived. So I did what any journalist would do and got the phone book and started ringing up the Bungies in Adelaide. And finally, Richard Bungy answered the phone. He's still alive today. He's... His memory comes and goes. He limps a little, but he's a lovely man. He loves his father, builds all the planes that he flew in little models, never misses an event in his father's name. In the Canberra War Memorial, the very Spitfire that his father flew over England is hanging on display.
And what did he say when you called him?
Well, he seemed a bit surprised that anyone was interested. Yeah, and this is the amazing thing.
He must be in his, what's in his
60s, yeah.
60s now, and right out of the blue.
Yeah.
This has happened.
And he lives in the same house that that his father and what his father grew up in fact.
How had he survived that shot in the head?
It was a miracle. The bullet just went through his brain and did minimal damage. And, you know, hanging there in the war memorial is his father's Spitfire. And he said to me, you know, I'd really love to, you know, before I die, sit in that Spitfire and sit in the seat that my father sat in. You know, he does all this stuff to... He said to me, I think I just do all these things to be close to my dad. It's just the most amazing father-son story in the end that began as a war story that interested me vicariously. And it was just the most touching thing I've ever worked on.
He'd have no memory, of course, of his father shooting him.
No, and for a long time he didn't know the details of what had happened, but eventually, as he became an adult, he started sifting for answers and found this out. Now, the amazing thing is a lot of people, I suppose, would react, in his position, would react badly to that, but, you know, he's totally forgiving of his father and, you know, war did something to him that we'll never know is pretty much the way he looks at it.
War and grief.
Yeah.
War and grief could undo the very best of us then.
And these were extraordinary times. You know, going through those old newspapers, you know, I found suicide was a very popular form of dispatch. And you've got to remember, you know, there was no such thing as counselling or therapy back then. So these people have been thrown into the most extraordinary circumstance, you know, a world war where they're sent to kill people and watch friends be slaughtered in front. And then they come back home and they've got to get on with life.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
And we're bringing you a whole lot of weird and macabre true stories from Australian history. That's because Jack Marks is here today. What else would he be talking about? Jack's new book is called Australian Tragic, Gripping Tales from the Dark Side of Our History. Did you like this sort of stuff when you were a kid, Jack?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of what led me to this. Is I loved those magazines like Amazing Tales and Macabre Stories and stuff. You know, things that gave you the creeps or... you know, particularly the true ones. You know, there's a lot more weight of darkness when you know that something's true. I've always been. I mean, they say that truth is stranger than fiction, but you know that's not true. I mean, I've always said, you know, watching a baby be delivered from the body of the one you love is a very strange thing, but it's nowhere near as strange as that moment when the giant slug sucks that bloke's brains out of his head in Starship Troopers. Fiction is stranger than fact, but yes. The fact that fact is fact is what makes it strange. You know, the fact that these things do actually happen all around us. You know, in the neighbourhood next to yours. You know, all through history is something that really fascinates me, and the fact that these tiny incidents that probably don't amount to much with regards to the turn of the earth can nonetheless change histories for a whole lot of generations of people in ways they'll never know.
There are a fair few scoundrels in your book. Right up there at the top of the list is a man called R.A. Cunningham, the greatest scoundrel on earth.
Well, I guess, you know... I like to think he perhaps thought he was doing a good thing, but what he was, he's the fellow who was employed by P.T. Barnum, the famous circus.
Greatest show on earth.
The greatest show on earth. He was sent by P.T. Barnum to come to sail the world and gather as many macabre examples of tribal savages as he could. So, you know, his job was to round up the Zulus and the Hottentots and the cannibals.
Pygmies.
And he came to Palm Island and lifted seven Palm Islanders. You know, this is, I think, 1890, thereabouts.
How did he induce a group of Aboriginal people to leave everything they knew behind and come with him?
In those days, Aborigines from that region scored a lot of work pearling with fishermen and stuff. So it wasn't unusual for them to climb onto boats and go away for a couple of days.
So it'd be just, he'd just say, I've got a job for you, get on the boat and I'll give you
the
some
story,
work.
The story, Alan Palm Island, who's a direct descendant of Tambo, who was one of the fellas I mentioned in the book, he told me that the legend in his family was that Tambo had just been told he was going on a trip and he'd see everyone a bit later. It was days later when they looked up in the sky and realised that the stars were changing and dipping over the horizon.
The boat to San Francisco.
On the boat to San Francisco. I mean, think about that. It's for us to liken that to any experience we might feel. It would be like you and I being invited by aliens to hop on a spacecraft and then realizing halfway to another star that we weren't coming back.
So he'd somehow persuaded a group of, were they men, women and children?
Yeah, yeah. And it's fascinating, you know, to go through, we tend to believe that people back then were a bit simple or, you know, weren't really hip to human rights. But I found this very fascinating moment in New South Wales Parliament where someone stands up and says, you know, I've heard that this character is taking these Indigenous people. This is wrong. I don't know if they understand where they're going. And there's, you know, just a day's worth of hubbub in Parliament about it. But unfortunately, it doesn't stop what's happening, and they.
So we really can't say that they were naive. They were somehow unknowing.
They were
alert to the moral issue at stake here.
You come across too many examples of people who think in much the same way that civil libertarians do today, to write off to lounge on the old "they were the days" sort of excuse. But anyway, these. The amazing thing is they got to San Francisco. They were then bundled onto a train which went the entire breadth of the United States. Can you just imagine what these seven Aborigines from Palm Island were thinking as they looked out the window and saw Nevada and
Milwaukee,
everything rushing past the window of a train, and then the setting up of the big top in Baltimore with all the elephants and the tigers. And, you know, it just would have been a remarkable experience.
You write in your book too that P.T. Barnum, of course, was a famous liar. You know, he found some 80-year-old toothless woman and called her the 160-year-old
George Washington's mother, I think. That's right, George Washington's nurse.
At 160. Yeah.
There was another famous freak show San Francisco, I think it was, or maybe on the West Coast, that for years and years, well into the 20th century, was keeping an exhibit that was allegedly Abraham Lincoln's last stool as collected from the toilets of the Ford Theatre before his assassination. I mean, I think it was in the 70s that some rich magazine editor decided to get it biologically tested and found that there were Twinkies and things in there. You know, things that
what mind came up with that?
It's fabulous stuff. But, you know, I mean,
empty a chamber pot and call that Abraham Lincoln's last bowel movement.
Very well for me to scoff at this sort of stuff. But in many ways, this book is kind of. I feel very much like I'm presenting my own little freak show, like opening and closing curtains to these bizarre.
So what became then of these poor Aboriginal people who were brought over to be exhibited like monkeys, I suppose, wild animals?
Most unfortunately, they very quickly died of disease. They just weren't their immune systems weren't, you know, hip to what was happening in the United States or Europe. They toured the United States. They toured Europe, but. Then suddenly the trail goes cold. Now, what's interesting about this, though, is it was a Sydney anthropologist by the name of Rosalind Poignant who was in Cleveland, Ohio in the early 90s and stumbled across the corpse, the embalmed corpse of Tambo in the basement of a funeral home in Cleveland. And she did some amazing detective work and found that he was from Palm Island. And it was her work that got his body brought back here. And today you can see his grave in his beloved hills in Palm Island. Almost 100 years to the day that he got on that boat and left, he was buried in Palm Island. It's just an amazing story.
Everything that's wrong with the 19th century is in that story. That's an amazing story. Jack, let's move a bit closer to the present day. A story of from Canberra in 1952, a man called Peter Shinnick and his girlfriend. What happened on the night in question?
This is one of the stories that I really love because it's such a small, comparatively small incident.
But it's a moment of perfect horror too.
Yeah, it's Peter Shinnick, who was dating a young nurse from Queanbeyan in 53, I think it was, and they were going out one night. They'd been dating for a couple of weeks, and on an intersection in the city, they had an accident. He just lost control of his motorcycle. He was knocked out cold. She was badly injured. It was late at night. She saw it was a lonely stretch of road. She saw a car coming and hailed it, and to her relief, the car slowed and stopped. Unfortunately, she had no idea who was driving that vehicle, a fellow by the name of Dixon, who had quite a lot of form. 18 months earlier, or 2 years earlier, he'd been sent to prison for 18 months for attempting to rape his sister while she had a baby under her arm. So naturally, he picked her up, promising to take her to the hospital, and raped her on the way to the hospital. Now, the interesting thing about this is, I found Peter Shinnick. You know, I found this story in, you know, just a couple of clippings in the Canberra Times. But I opened the white. You know, it's amazing how you can open the white pages and just lucky dip. You know, I mean, there are a few Shinnicks, I think, maybe about 17 or 18. But I landed on the right one first go. And he's still alive. He's 80. He's still working. Very surprised that I was bringing up this incident from his deep past.
Was he distressed?
Not distressed, but I think he was disturbed because the last time he saw her was outside the court, and he said she was very traumatized, and he felt, you know, that the right thing to do was leave her alone. Now, what interests me about that story is who knows what that incident interrupted. Maybe Peter Shinnick and this young nurse might have married, had kids of their own. As it turned out, Peter Shinnick moved along, married, had kids of his own. You know, that moment on that intersection snuffed out lives that we don't know, and gave life to the ones that exist. And I'm just very intrigued and frightened, I guess, by that idea that a tiny accident or movement can irrevocably change the future in ways we just don't know.
It's like an Ian McEwan novel, really, isn't it? Except it's a true story. It's it's and all the sadder for that. How did this is 1952 in Canberra. Yeah. It was always rumoured when I was living in Canberra, the media would, I don't think there's probably looking back any truth in this, but there was rumours that the media were looking to, police and media were looking to suppress stories of unpleasantness coming out of Canberra in order to detract from the Canberra as a nice place to come and live with your family and join the public service. There's probably no truth in that whatsoever, but I wonder how the Canberra media reported that story at the time, that moment of perfect horror. A woman's had a motorcycle accident, she's broken bones, and then she's sexually assaulted by the man who's come to rescue her.
I think they were happy to report that one because it was so quickly solved. You know, there was a very neat tie-up, you know, we've got our man, and he was sentenced to death in the court. The very inconvenient truth was his death sentence was commuted to life in prison, and we don't really know what happened to him, or at least I don't. But you do find examples of that whitewashing all the time in sort of small-town Australian history. There's another story in the book about Claude Valentine Batson around the area of Jingellic on the New South Wales-Victorian border. And he went bonkers for a couple of days and fired on a bunch of picnickers who he had a few grievances, very slight grievances with, killed a couple, went bush for a few days, and there was this, for about a week or two, it dominated the newspapers in Melbourne. Like, this man was armed to the teeth, familiar with the terrain, was in the hills, was it was like Rambo for its time. This was in the 1920s or 1930s. And then they caught him, and he turned out to be kind of rather a benign simpleton who got sent to a lunatic, you know, all of a sudden. There's this one report in the paper that said the trial's over. He's been sent to a mental institution. Nothing else. I called local historians. I could find no evidence of Claude Valentine Batson's existence. a whole community have kind of
forgotten.
Well, not just forgotten, but expunged him from the record. This wasn't that long ago, and these were the times when, you know, if someone had a baby out of wedlock or something, it was all hushed up, and the mother would pretend to be the grandmother would pretend to be the mother, and we lived in, you know, Australia was not always a liberal society. It was very harsh, and it was within it. There are people still alive who remember what Australian life was like and when it was like that.
Jack Marks is here this morning, Australian journalist with stories of Australian tragedy, true stories that you've probably never heard about. Here's one which you probably have heard about in its own way. This is one of the things that I suppose reading journals, as I said, is that you're always in the moment of the incident in question. And this is the tendency of journalism to always live in the present and forget about the past. Mm. No greater example have we seen with that than with the death of Steve Irwin. You talk about the way Steve Irwin, which was reported, the way his activities were being reported before he died and after he died. Just take me through that contrast. You can't help but notice.
I should point out that story is dead in the middle of the book, because I regard it as something of an intermission, because the rest of the stories are very much tales told in, you know, that ethereal way. But you know, this time I just thought, something that always bugged me, when Steve Irwin died, and there was all this, we have lost our man in, you know, our hero in khaki. I thought, hang on, this doesn't wash with what the media has been saying for the last 18 months. So I actually spent the time, one day decided to bite the bullet and sit down and go through every mention of Steve Irwin in the newspapers 18 months prior to his death. And sure enough, there he was, this buffoon, this, you know, idiot of the year, this, you know, why do we have to endure, you know,
he's an embarrassment to
across
Australia.
The board. Yeah, we did not like Steve Irwin.
And did he make comments to that effect, that he seemed to be better received in the United States than in his own country?
I think every now and then he'd make a mention, like, I think I'll pull stumps and go and live in the United States. And of course, the tabloids will bully for you. You know, we'll show you the way to the airport. You know, he was really despised. And I think Terry Irwin would remember that. I think, I didn't speak to Terry Irwin about it, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if the great outpouring of grief and gushing that happened after his death, she took with a lump in her throat.
Because often from the same journalists?
I think so. Certainly from the same organs.
Yes.
And, you know, it was a great example. You know, the hatred of Steve Irwin was a great example of tabloid hysteria, where, you know, they make a decision, they read the public mood, and they whip it up and fan it for a couple of weeks. And
there,
you know,
he is dangling his kid near a crocodile.
Right, you know. After,
read the mood.
Right, after that, you know, that was unstoppable. That he was a pariah. And I found a great letter to the editor in the Sydney Morning Herald from someone. I wonder what this person has thought ever since. But they wrote, "One of these days I wish one of the animals that Steve Irwin harasses will kill him." And I think, I wonder if that person feels like they sort of pointed the bone these days. They're wandering around with a bit of crap karma. But, you know, it's interesting that suddenly the tune changed. And we've seen it again recently with Michael Jackson. I mean, I don't need to go into the crimes that Michael Jackson was accused of and quite possibly bought his way out of. But suddenly he's the king of pop and we've lost this, for heaven's sake.
We're always living in the present in the media. It's always the present. But past is forgotten, the future is unknown, so we're in the present. And Steve Irwin was too dead to fling this hypocrisy back in their faces.
I also loved there was the manager of, in amongst all this grief that was, you know, coming apart after he died, there was the manager of the Stingray Cafe somewhere around these parts in Queensland, decided to take out an ad in the paper and say that regardless of what had happened, they were still open for business and selling the best ham and cheese rolls this side of the border. You know.
It's a funny old country. Jack Marks is here. He's written a book called Australian Tragic. Let's go back again, because we really can't ignore that tale of the Gray family who tried to escape from Goondiwindi down through the Murray-Darling system in a rickety old boat. This is I never heard this story before, and it's it just did my head in, Jack.
Yeah, it was one of the great, great ones that just sort of popped out of the pages of a newspaper and of old, and you know, dominated the local courthouse in Toowoomba for a short period. A fella tried to travel with his family from Goondiwindi to Adelaide. I didn't even know that was possible, by river, by boat.
Through the Murray-Darling system, yes.
Right, apparently yes. you could do it, it's or maybe you still though, can. Yeah, well, you know, this was we're talking in the 30s. And it didn't work out. There'd been floodwaters and the boat upended and the man of the family lost his whole family.
Tried to rescue them out of the surging waters. And
but they all drowned, and police found a very distraught man on the side of the river and, you know, did an enormous search. And for days and days, the papers are talking about the search for this poor man's family.
And what was he calling himself?
He was Mr. Gray and his family, Lillian Gray and the children. But what eventually came out was that he wasn't the husband and father at all. He was a lodger who'd taken in with Mr. Gray and his family, fallen in love with Lillian Gray, and taken off with her and the kids.
He had a great relationship with the kids too. So they were all willing to go with him.
They were willing to go with him, although whether they knew precisely what they were going for, how long they were going for, or anything, we just can't know. But
so,
you know,
so
he
his
claimed,
name was May.
His name was May, and he was passing himself off as Mr. Gray because he knew Gray would have put the alert out when he came home and found his wife and children and the lodger missing. And, you know, police had set up roadblocks and everything in search of them, but didn't think to set up a block on the river.
So the truth came out that he wasn't Mr. Gray, he was Mr. May instead. What about the real Mr. Gray?
The real Mr. Gray is the saddest story. He was a milkman in Brisbane, never missed a run, you know, for 5 years or something, and spoke to the newspapers about, you know, how he always happy to go off to work each day with the vision in his head of his wife and little ones at home. And the day after the trial, he was back on his milk run, you know, a little bit sadder and unable to think of these little faces that made him want to cry. But, you know, he had to sit there in court while May said Lillian Gray wanted to come with me. She couldn't stand being with him anymore. Evidently, he wasn't the bedsman that milkmen are legendary for.
It's awful. It's truly awful.
I know. I mean, out there somewhere there are descendants of these people, but you know, the story of them, their little boat coming apart on the river and the children sort of sinking underneath is just appalling, you know, all from the court documents. And, you know, once again, these are stories that don't form the cornerstone of any political history of this nation or something, but
I say a lot about the Depression era and I suppose lust and incidents and all these
sure
things,
you know, yeah. he bought a boat primarily I think because he couldn't really afford a car that would get them to Adelaide, but you know what strange times, and this is only you know, the Harbour Bridge is only as old as these stories, you know, this is in the modern age.
Jack, just finally, this really the saddest story in your book is the very first one, and you've given it the name Moloch, and there's a good reason for that. And the woman at the centre of it is Jenny. Tell me how you met Jenny.
Moloch is the story that started the whole book, because I originally went in search for a story that told me of the horror of Sydney Luna Park fire of 79, where the ghost train burned down, seven people died inside. And I was really spooked by the horror of dying in a ghost train with all the sounds and the, you know, ooh, and, you know, can you imagine a more ghoulish end? Anyway, I couldn't find a story that satisfied me, so suddenly this bright light occurred to me. Hang on, you're a journalist, go and write it yourself. So I started getting stuck into the coroner's report and the old newspaper reports, and through Martin Sharp, the artist in Sydney who keeps in contact with... He was one of the last people to paint the face of Luna Park before the fire, but he keeps in contact with Jenny Poitevin, who lost her husband and two only sons in the fire. She was standing outside the ghost train when it burned to a cinder.
You write that the family had been going through a rough patch, and to cheer them up, they went from country New South Wales to Sydney to go to an outing in Luna Park. What happened? There's a creepy incident that happens to them before they even get to Luna Park.
Well, you see, Moloch was an ancient pagan god of child sacrifice. The legend is that this effigy, a giant metal figure in the shape of a man with a bull's head, would be built, and children would be fed into the fire in its belly. And Moloch loved, you know, to see mothers mourn. So, you know, this is a legend that only came to Jenny later. When they were on the night when the fire happened, they were in Circular Quay, and this strange procession of minstrels and started snaking through the crowd. And at the head of this procession was a man with a loincloth and the head of a bull. And Damien, the eldest son, who was only six, was a little bit spooky and didn't like things like this. So he cowered behind his mother. Out of nowhere, this bull creature saw him, moved over and placed his hand on his shoulder, and a photograph was taken. And that's the last photograph that exists of Damien Godson. Hours later, he was burned in this fire. And, of course, Martin Sharp, for example, is very freaked out. He sees Moloch as as represented by the face of Luna Park, you know, the same sort of thing, attracting children, the fire that came from within there, and Jenny's significantly spooked by that as well. But the interesting thing about her is her personal story wound up being more interesting to me than my fascination about the carnage. And she was truly a, you know, I think of all the people I've interviewed in my journalistic career, you know, pop stars and movie stars, and it's Jenny who's left the most lasting effect on me. You know, what a strong person to just still be sucking air after 3 decades of having to deal with this, you know, every day and night of her life.
And that sort of brings us to the image on the front of your book, Australian Tragic Jack, which is the face of Luna Park there, which is equally sinister as it is delightful.
Well,
isn't it?
As a child, one of my earliest memories is being taken on the train all the way from Newcastle to Luna Park and refusing to walk through the mouth. I had to be put on the train and taken all the way back to Newcastle.
I think when I was a kid, I ran through that mouth without a second thought, but perhaps in my imagination.
You're a better man than I.
Jack, it's great having you in today, and these are truly amazing stories, and thank you so much for coming in today in conversation.
Absolute pleasure.
That's Jack Marks, and his book is called Australian Tragic.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.